22nd. Theodore is right. The bonhomme has taken me into his favour. I protest I don't see how he was to escape it. Je l'ai bien soigné, as they say in Paris. I don't blush for it. In one coin or another I must repay his hospitality, which is certainly very liberal. Theodore dots his I's, crosses his T's, verifies his quotations, while I set traps for that famous curiosity. This speaks vastly well for my powers. He pretends to be surprised at nothing, and to possess in perfection, poor, pitiable old fop, the art of keeping his countenance. But repeatedly I know I have made him stare. As for his corruption, which I spoke of above, it's a very pretty piece of wickedness, but it strikes me as a purely intellectual matter. I imagine him never to have had any real senses. He may have been unclean morally. He's not very tidy now, but he never can have been what the French call a viveur. He's too delicate. He's of a feminine turn, and what woman was ever a viveur? He likes to sit in his chair and read scandal. Talk scandal, make scandal, so far as he may without catching a cold or bringing on a headache. I already feel as if I had known him a lifetime. I read him as clearly as if I had. I know the type to which he belongs. I have encountered first and last a good many specimens of it. He's neither more nor less than a gossip flanked by a coxcomb and an egotist. He's shallow, vain, cold, superstitious, timid, pretentious, capricious, a pretty list of foibles. And yet, for all this, he has his good points. Page 11. His caprices are sometimes generous, and his rebellion against the ugliness of life frequently makes him do kind things. His memory, for trifles, is remarkable, and, where his own performance are not involved, his taste is excellent. He has no courage for evil more than for good. He is the victim, however, of more illusions with regard to himself than I ever knew a single brain to shelter. At the age of 20, poor, ignorant, and remarkably handsome, he married a woman of immense wealth, many years his senior. At the end of 3 years, she very considerately took herself off, and left him to the enjoyment of his freedom and riches. If he had remained poor, he might from time to time have rubbed at random against the truth, and would be able to recognize the touch of it. But he wraps himself in his money as in a wadded dressing-gown, and goes trundling through life on his little gold wheels. The greater part of his career, from the time of his marriage till about 10 years ago, was spent in Europe, which, superficially, he knows very well. He has lived in 50 places, known thousands of people, and spent a very large fortune. At one time, I believe, he spent considerably too much, trembled for an instant on the verge of a pecuniary crash, but recovered himself and found himself more frightened than hurt, yet audibly recommended to lower his pitch. He passed 5 years in a species of penitent seclusion on the lake of, I forget what, his genius seems to be partial to lakes, and laid the basis of his present magnificent taste for literature. I can't call him anything but magnificent in this respect, so long as he must have his punctuation done by a nature distinguée. At the close of this period, by economy, he had made up his losses. His turning the screw during those relatively impecunious years represents, I am pretty sure, the only act of resolution of his life. It was rendered possible by his morbid, by his actually pusillanimous dread of poverty. He doesn't feel safe without a 500,000 between him and starvation. Meanwhile, he had turned from a young man into an old man. His health was broken, his spirit was jaded, and I imagine, to do him justice, that he began to feel a certain natural filial longings for this dear American mother of us all. They say the most hopeless truants and triflers have come to it. He came to it, at all events. He packed up his books and pictures and gimcracks and bade farewell to Europe. This house which he now occupies belonged to his wife's estate. She had, for sentimental reasons of her own, commended it to his particular care. On his return, he came to see it, liked it, turned a parcel of carpenters and upholsterers into it, and by inhabiting it for 9 years transformed it into the perfect dwelling which I find it. Here he has spent all his time, with the exception of the usual winter's visit to New York, a practice recently discontinued owing to the increase of his ailments and the projection of his famous memoirs. His life has finally come to be passed in comparative solitude. He tells of various distant relatives as well as intimate friends of both sexes who used formerly to be entertained at his cost, but with each of them, in the course of time, he seems to have succeeded in quarrelling. Page 12. Throughout life, evidently, he has had capital fingers for plucking off parasites. Rich, lonely, and vain, he must have been fair game for the race of social sycophants and cormorants, and it is much to the credit of his sharpness and that instinct of self-defence which nature bestows even on the weak that he has not been despoiled and exploité. Apparently they have been all burglars. I maintain that something is to be done with him still, but one must work in obedience to certain definite laws. Dr. Jones, his physician, tells me that in point of fact he has had for the past 10 years an unbroken series of favourites, protégés, heirs presumptive, but that each in turn, by some fatally false movement, has spilled his pottage. The doctor declares, moreover, that they were mostly very common people. Gradually the old man seems to have developed a preference for 2 or 3 strictly exquisite intimates over a throng of your vulgar pensioners. His tardy literary schemes, too, fruit of his all but sapless senility, have absorbed more and more of his time and attention. The end of all is, therefore, that Theodore and I have him quite to ourselves, and that it behooves us to hold our porringers straight. Poor, pretentious old simpleton. It's not your fault, after all, that he fancies himself a great little man. How are you to judge of a stature of mankind when men have forever addressed you on their knees? Peace and joy to his innocent fatuity. He believes himself the most rational of men. In fact, he's the most superstitious. He fancies himself a philosopher, an inquirer, a discoverer. He has not yet discovered that he is a humbug, that Theodore is a prig, and that I am an adventurer. He prides himself on his good manners, his urbanity, his knowing a rule of conduct for every occasion in life. My private impression is that his skinny old bosom contains unsuspected treasures of impertinence. He takes his stand on his speculative audacity, his direct, undaunted gaze at the universe. In truth, his mind is haunted by 100 dingy old-world spectres and theological phantasms. He imagines himself one of the most solid of men. He is essentially one of the hollowest. He thinks himself ardent, impulsive, passionate, magnanimous, capable of boundless enthusiasm for an idea or a sentiment. It is clear to me that on no occasion of disinterested action can he ever have done anything in time. He believes, finally, that he has drained the cup of life to the dregs, that he has known in its bitterest intensity every emotion of which the human spirit is capable, that he has loved, struggled, suffered. Mere vanity, all of it. He has never loved anyone but himself. He has never suffered from anything but an undigested supper or an exploded pretension. He has never touched with the end of his lips the vulgar bowl from which the mass of mankind quaffs its floods of joy and sorrow. Well, the long and short of it all is that I honestly pity him. He may have given sly knocks in his life, but he can't hurt anyone now. I pity his ignorance, his weakness, his pusillanimity. He has tasted the real sweetness of life no more than its bitterness. He has never dreamed, nor experimented, nor dared. He has never known any but mercenary affection. Page 13. Neither men nor women have risked aught for him, for his good spirits, his good looks, his empty pockets. How I should like to give him, for once, a real sensation.